Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk is entitled Meditation and Living on the Dot by Lama Adam Berner. Our lives can feel so spread out, stretched from the distant past into a far uncertain future. And that's only this week. Can't we just have a moment in the moment? Using the foundational Buddhist meditation of shamatha, or calm abiding, we'll explore how the simplicity of a meditation session can come along with you throughout your day, positively impacting your experience and everyone around you. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to Columbus KTC's Dharma Talks on Sunday mornings at 11:30. Today, I'm going to talk about living on the dot, which kind of evolved in the way I was thinking about this from when I came up with the title to now in the content of what I'm going to speak about. But really, I have a kind of a framework, but part of what I want to talk about is just kind of being in the moment and living in the moment and reacting with a fresh take and in every moment. So that's kind of the overarching theme. So with that in mind, if anybody has any specific things they've been thinking about or questions or certain topics that they want to hear about today, I'm generally going to be talking about meditation and how we establish good habits and kind of ironically, how we establish the habits that allow us to act with spontaneity. So if you have any specific things, put it in the chat and I will try to kind of weave it in. And I think this will be kind of nice because I miss seeing everybody. I'm kind of just looking at my own face on the screen here. So it'd be nice to have a little interplay, you know? So before we begin, let's do the refuge prayer. So we'll actually do the refuge prayer, and then I'd actually like to do the four immeasurables as well. So we'll chant these in English. We'll chant the refuge prayer three times, and then we'll chant the four immeasurables as well three times. So I'll put those on the screen. And so three times in English for the refuge prayer. That's the first four lines you're seeing on the screen. Until I reach enlightenment, I take refuge in all the Buddhas and in the Dharma, and in the Noble Sangha. By the merit of accomplishing the six perfections, may I achieve Buddhahood for the benefit of all sentient beings. Until I reach enlightenment, I take refuge in all the Buddhas, and in the Dharma, and in the Noble Sangha. By the merit of accomplishing the six perfections, may I achieve Buddhahood for the benefit of all sentient beings. Until I reach enlightenment, I take refuge in all the Buddhas, and in the Dharma, and in the Noble Sangha. By the merit of accomplishing the six perfections, may I achieve Buddhahood for the benefit of all sentient beings. And then scroll up. Okay, so now these four lines, we'll say this three times in English, generating bodhicitta, the wish to attain Buddhahood so that we can benefit all sentient beings. May all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May they be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May they not be separated from the highest bliss, which is without suffering. May they come to rest in great impartiality, free from attachment and aversion, free from near and far. May all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May they be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May they not be separated from the highest bliss, which is without suffering. May they come to rest in great impartiality, free from attachment and aversion, free from near and far. May all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May they be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May they never be separated from the highest bliss, which is without suffering. May they come to rest in great impartiality, free from attachment and aversion, free from near and far. Aden sawe la la rin po che na ki chi wo pe ni ten chu na ka ten chan po ko ni chi sun te po sun tu ki ni ju psa du so Okay. Thank you. So I have so many thoughts about this topic today. I did something a little bit different. I've got like a good framework, but I'm kind of just going to roll with it today, which it seems like it's with the theme. And an interesting thing for me has been in this last 2 years, like getting used to the fact that there's a lot of repetition that has to happen in sharing Dharma, you know, and it's kind of conversationally, like we're a lot of us are usually on guard for that, you know, like how many times have you told somebody, you know, a familiar of yours, like, you've told me that story before, you know? And so we think about that stuff and I think about it. And it's interesting because I don't know how many times Lama Kathy's probably taught the Four Noble Truths, you know, I can't imagine. And I noticed we have to repeat ourselves, you know, and we need to repeat ourselves with these things because they don't, they don't sink in immediately. We need to process them. We need to hear them different ways. So, one thing that's been helpful for me lately is that I had a little realization a couple months ago that each of these little bits of information are kind of like songs. Like I used to be a musician. I mean, I guess I still am. But, you know, you have a repertoire of songs and you play them. And the more you play them, the better they get. And so I'm kind of starting to think about all this stuff as like songs, you know, like so each time's a little bit different. And it's always good to hear a song again. So if it's a song you like, you know, so that's kind of one of the things I've been thinking about lately is like having a repertoire and then expanding that repertoire. So I have been starting focusing primarily on Hinayana topics, foundational vehicle kind of stuff. That's like the first cycle of the Buddha's teaching. And it's helped me a lot to kind of be able to look at these individual things from different angles. So that's, of course, something that you can do as well. You know, like there's no reason why you shouldn't try to kind of take the same approach in your contemplation, I think. You know, it's definitely been helpful to me when I find interest in a topic to go to different sources, you know, like what does Kempo Carter Rinpoche say about this? What is the Karmapa said about this? What does Taisichi Rinpoche said about this? You know, with all those different approaches and different teachings, even maybe from the same teacher, there's sometimes one or several resonate particularly with us and kind of cut through the delusion. So I think it's a pretty interesting approach. I'm glad I found it because it's taken away a little bit of my self-consciousness about repeating myself. So I said a little bit earlier, if people are just tuning in, if there's any particular topics that this, like, let's say the title of the talk today is Living on the Dot. So if there's anything that makes you think of that you kind of want to hear about that would apply to you, put that in the chat and I'll be happy to try to weave it into what I'm going to cover today. So let's start with a recap of the Four Noble Truths, because it has been said that all of the Buddha's teachings are some elaboration on the Four Noble Truths. So contemplation of the Four Noble Truths is a foundational practice of all Buddhist traditions. And if all the teachings are elaborations of the Four Noble Truths, then they should also align with the Four Noble Truths. So it's a really good idea to kind of start there. So what the Buddha taught in his first teaching after attaining enlightenment was that discomfort is a part of life. That discomfort is kind of ever present in our experience, even in times of seeming happiness. And that discomfort, we call it suffering a lot of times in translation, but discomfort and dissatisfaction is really what we're talking about. And that can be, you know, extreme situations too. but it is also just the feeling that something's not right and that something needs to be rearranged to try to kind of fix some unidentifiable imperfection in our experience. So that's the first noble truth, that discomfort or suffering is a part of life. And the second noble truth is that that has a cause. And the cause the Buddha identified was self-clinging. And it's a little tough to understand the idea of that. I mean, there's some ways to talk about it that are easier to understand than others. In particular, I think the idea that we can constantly change and renew. We don't generally recognize that. We cling to a view of who we are or who we think we are and think that that kind of doesn't change. And in fact, we a lot of times experience discomfort because of the fact that things are not, that our environment or our mental state is not aligning with or supporting our static view of who we are. So we have this sense that we are a certain thing. And then if anything kind of bumps up and makes us want to change or need to change or have to adapt in some way, that will trigger some discomfort, some dissatisfaction. And that's attachment, you know, that is, that self-clinging is attachment. And sometimes that's attachment to stuff, you know, things that we want or things that we think we need. It can be attachment, you know, to extremes too, extreme viewpoints. So that's the second noble truth, that that the cause of our discomfort, the cause of our suffering, is this clinging to a self and all the ways that that manifests. And then the third noble truth is that since there's a cause for suffering, if we remove that cause, we can achieve the end of suffering. And the fourth noble truth is that there's a path to do that. So that path is the Eightfold Noble Path, which is eight sets of, right speech, right conduct, a bunch of eight rights, basically. And you can sum that up as do no harm, practice only virtue, tame your mind. This is the teaching of the Buddha. So when I mentioned earlier about repetition, it's interesting because in one sense, the answer to every question in the Buddhist view is do no harm, practice only virtue, tame your mind. And this is the teaching of the Buddha indicates that anything, you know, that accords with those, it accords with the teaching of the Buddha. And if you're considering doing something or some course of action that doesn't or that does do harm and isn't a practice of virtue and does not help to tame your mind, that would not be the wise course of action. So why would it not be the wise course of action? Because it would cause suffering. It would be a cause of suffering. The Buddha said, I teach suffering and the cause of, or I'm sorry, the Buddha said, I teach suffering and the end of suffering. So all of these teachings should be getting at our attachment, our self-clinging, and taking that head on. So that's a really important thing to remember, because it is easy with attachment, particularly when we begin on this path, to start to think about renouncing and giving up our ties and our attachments, to think that that what we really need to do is latch onto and attach to ritual, you know, or philosophy of Buddhism. And there is a turning of our attention. There is a turning of the emphasis of our motivation. But it can also become an unhealthy attachment, you know? So we need to know that, like, these are methods that lead to the end of suffering, but it's the end of suffering that we're trying to achieve, not like our idea of what a perfect Buddhist is. So again, those four noble truths, that discomfort is a part of life. Attachment is the cause of that. We can achieve the end of this discomfort. And that there's a path that leads to that. So the second time the Buddha said it, he said, what we need to do is understand suffering. So this discomfort, this dissatisfaction, is what is we need to understand. So when we meet with discomfort in our lives, our reaction should be some inquisitiveness. Our reaction ought to be a desire to get to know it better. And that doesn't mean masochism, you know, that doesn't mean to like welcome and create suffering for ourselves, but it does mean to look at it, to take the time to examine it and get to know it better. Because as we start to even just take a moment to be with the suffering, we can start to see where it's coming from, you know, and we start to experientially identify its cause. Because the Buddha said the cause of suffering is attachment, but that's just a sentence, right? Like, we need to see that ourselves and to do that again and again and again. So repetition, again, is kind of important here. So when we meet with discomfort, we need to at least briefly take a moment, if we can, and try to understand it. That's what the Buddha said is to be done with that first noble truth. The second noble truth, the cause of suffering being attachment or self-clinging, that self-clinging is what is to be abandoned. So we understand very clearly now from just those first two noble truths that if anything is to be gotten rid of, it's attachment. That's what's to be gotten rid of. And the suffering is what's to be understood. So that's a really important point, because so much of our time is spent in trying to abandon the suffering and without even really a thought to the cause. So understand discomfort, abandon its cause. And what we should be striving for, what we're trying to achieve, is the cessation of suffering, the end of suffering. That one we get. Right? I mean, nobody is out looking for suffering. Everybody is seeking happiness. And that looks different. It manifests in different ways for different people. But everybody's out, you know, trying to find happiness in their own way. And so we understand that we need to achieve the cessation of suffering. But we've been going about the how the wrong way. You know, we've been trying to abandon the suffering rather than its cause. And that's why the fourth noble truth, the Buddha said, is what is to be relied upon. So we need to rely upon the path. So this is a lot about the path is not super intuitive for us, because we're so used to abandoning the suffering and not spending any time looking at our discomfort and trying to understand, you know, how it arises and where the attachment is. So the path is what's to be relied upon. And the path, as I said, is do no harm, practice only virtue, tame your mind. And that's the teaching of the Buddha. So in a sense, like I said, we could always just repeat those four lines as to how to do anything, right? But we need to elaborate a little bit more and why those four lines are the answer to all of our situations. Is because of the Four Noble Truths. You know, understanding the Four Noble Truths helps us understand why those four lines, do no harm, practice only virtue, tame your mind, are in fact the answer and can help us achieve some confidence in that. And if there's any doubt about what was said so far, the Buddha, the third time he taught this this teaching, he said, other than suffering, there's nothing to be understood. Other than attachment, the cause of suffering, there is nothing to be abandoned. Other than the cessation of suffering, there is nothing to be achieved. And other than the path, there's nothing to be relied upon. So that may not be that easy to digest right now, but with contemplation and with an experiential understanding of these teachings, with our own examples in our own life, seeing this stuff work, that starts to make sense. So the other thing I wanted to, the other kind of thread I wanted to talk about today was, I've been thinking a lot lately about how many kinds of meditation there are and how wonderful it is that meditation has become so ubiquitous in our culture, but With it has come a fair amount of confusion. And I think it's important. I'm going to start actually with a question I got. I gave a talk the other day, and someone, and I talked about roughly the same material as today. And somebody asked at the end of the talk, and I want to start with this. They said, are you saying that like meditation that is relaxational, you know, like there's a lot of apps now that people have that are really designed to calm you down, you know, and that's that can be really helpful. But they said, are you saying that can be dangerous? And I'm glad they asked that question because, and I'm starting with that because that's not what I'm saying exactly. But I do think it's important to talk about this because discomfort, as the Buddha said, is what we need to get to understand a little bit. And if every time we experience even a glimmer of discomfort, we do something to distract ourselves from it and replace it with something else, we're never really going to get started on this path. And so it's important to understand when we are retreating into comfort and when we're actually working with the Buddhist path. Because we will need to retreat into comfort sometimes, but it is a retreat, you know, and sometimes you strategically fall back, you know, I'm using battle analogies without any historical battle history knowledge, but I'm guessing that there are times where in battles we fall back. And if we're in a battle against our attachment, you know, trying to eliminate that attachment, I think there's probably times when the right call, I'm sure there are times when the right call is to kind of get into our comfort zone. Like we need that sometimes. We need to honor that because we aren't Buddhas yet. In a way we are already, but it doesn't feel that way all the time, right? So sometimes we do need to honor the need for comfort and the need for relaxation. But we should know what we're doing. And in particular, related to like relaxational meditations and apps and things like that, I think where that could be dangerous is if someone, and I'm sure there are people in this boat, it has to be the case, if someone was to think that just relaxing on the cushion like that is meditation and that's the end of the story. If that were the path someone took, they would never achieve the end of suffering that way. So it's certain that meditation, if it helps them to calm down, will help them to calm down sometimes when they're stressed out or they're experiencing anxiety or feeling overwhelmed. Those meditations can help you calm down in the moment. And that can have a really positive effect in the moment, and it can have a positive effect even a little bit afterwards. But the point of those relaxational kinds of meditation, if the point of your meditation is to calm down on the cushion, it's a distraction from the suffering. It is not dealing with the cause of the suffering directly. It's like, to use a medical term, it's like a palliative treatment. You know, it's dealing with the symptoms rather than the cause. And it works primarily in the moment. So like with the medication, you know, we talk about half-life, you know, which is half the time it takes for the half of the active dose to be in the body. And so the half-life on these relaxational meditations is pretty short, you know. And that's the opposite of that would be like a foundational Buddhist meditation of shamatha. You know, it's important to note that the Tibetan word that we translate as meditation actually means to familiarize, to get to know better. So it's not a matter of tuning out stuff. It's a matter of getting to know how our minds work in kind of two aspects, right? So we want to know both what arises in our minds, you know, and when it arises, but also what do we do with what arises? So there's both this part where we're trying to just notice what's happening, But then we're also trying to notice what we do with what's happening. And in that way, we become more familiar with the way our experience works, the way our mind works. And that's familiarization. So through that familiarization, we become more skillful with our experience. And so it is kind of the idea where I asked a friend the other day, and thank you for your advice, about if there was a companion word for palliative, where, you know, if palliative care deals with the symptoms but not the cause, like a kind of treatment that does deal with the cause. And the best thing we could come up with was like corrective, because ultimately, like, things do kind of shift, and it's never like, you know, at least in medicine, it's not the case that all of a sudden everything's totally fixed forever, right? That'd be great. But so meditation in the Buddhist sense, Buddhist meditation is getting at the cause of the problem and trying to eliminate the cause. And that is possible. So meditation also has a much, much longer, Buddhist meditation has a much, much longer half-life. So to think in terms of that, the medication staying in the body for longer. So with a relaxational meditation, it's going to, you know, kind of be, it can leave very quickly. Like the benefits of the meditation, you can meditate, do a relaxational meditation, and an hour later, you're stressed out again. But the idea is that with Buddhist meditation, that builds up over time and will be there. You know, if you miss a day or two, it'll still have like sort of an active dose, you know, in you, you know, or in your experience. So that's a real benefit of Buddhist meditation, not to mention the fact that you're actually getting at the cause of the problem. So like, for instance, an example would be like a relaxational meditation is in a way like taking a Tylenol for a broken leg. Like it will probably help, or a painkiller, you know, it will help to remove the pain of the broken leg, but the issue that's causing the pain is still there and needs its own treatment for sure, right? So we need to do something to fix the actual problem itself. So it's important to understand that when we're going for comfort in our meditation, that is a temporary fix. And we need to be able to find a balance between our temporary needs and the ultimate goal, you know, which is to overcome this kind of suffering. So it's not that we can't ever do anything to relax. That's not what I'm saying. Rather, it's that the relaxing will never itself ultimately solve the problem. In fact, it will reinforce the recurrence of the problem, because it will make this habit of not dealing with the issue. And you know, habits, we're going to talk about habits in a minute here too, but the more you do something, the easier it is to do it again, and the less mindful you become of it as you repeat. So in order to influence positive habits, we need to remind ourselves of that, you know, that our relaxation should be a fallback in extreme cases. So let's take just a moment, and since I'm talking about shamatha, let's take just a couple moments and place the attention gently on the breath and just breathe naturally. And if you notice you're distracted, just bring your attention back to the breath. And that's a simple instruction in shamatha meditation, which we've been talking about. So just place the attention gently on the breath. And if you get if you get distracted, just bring your attention back. And we'll do that for just a minute. Okay, thanks. So I had a couple comments in the chat that we'll try to address right now to kind of reset. So the first one was, do you recommend getting into the cause or root of discomfort on the cushion or in a separate contemplation session? That's a really good question. So like this meditation, like shamatha, is a meditation that moves towards non-conceptuality. Any conceptuality that's built into this practice in the beginning is sort of training wheels. So we all start there. And so the instructions that you've received are what you should follow. And it's also the case that the mental technique for this practice is so seemingly, it's so short, really. You know, you can say it in two sentences. So we always try to kind of gussy it up a little bit. And so we always want to, I think most of the questions that come up about this type of a practice are sort of looking past what just the actual instruction is. Like, all we really need to do is place the attention on the breath. And if we notice we're distracted, bring the attention back. So it's a really good question, because that I would say that when you do that practice in meditation, that's all you're doing. So thinking about root causes of suffering, any kind of thinking would be something for a contemplation type session. And a good time to contemplate is before you do your shamatha, because that can be your motivation to do the practice, you know, and coming to a recognition of the root of discomfort is a good way to motivate to actually do the practice, to come up with a real personal motivation to do it, the personal recognition that that's something that you need to do. So another question here is, sometimes I'm paralyzed to act because I worry I'm missing something and that my response isn't the best response. I worry that I'm trying to avoid the suffering instead of being with it, or that I'm just creating a different narrative. I'm not sure how to know when to trust myself about changing a situation or when to push myself to remain in discomfort. Even if it seems like the best thing to do is to change the situation, do you have a suggestion on how to proceed when this happens? I definitely feel this one, you know. I think we've all probably felt this way. I know I have. So I think that the best device I have to think about this is Pema Chodron's learning zone diagram, where she talks about having a comfort zone in the middle. Like, it's like the center of a circle is the comfort zone. And then there's a ring in the middle that's the learning zone. And then the outer ring is this excessive risk zone. So we want to try to push ourselves to be in that learning zone. So that learning zone would be where we're engaging with the discomfort, trying to understand it. Like, we're withstanding a little discomfort, if you will, without trying to distract from it. So we want to try to stay in that zone as much as possible, because the thing that happens is, if we can gain some comfort in that learning zone, then our comfort zone actually grows, and we become more able to feel at ease in different situations, situations that may challenge us. I think a good example of this is yoga. You know, yoga is a really good physical example of this. There's really nothing about yoga that's awful, you know, or that's like painful, but it's a lot of it's not particularly comfortable. You know, we're sitting with an in, or standing, or bent over, or folded in a weird way into discomfort, you know. So, but we learn that we can handle that, you know, and there's a real sense of ability and power that comes with that. So, and that comes from that like learning zone kind of area. So, but we also, even in yoga, there's a point where you have to kind of stop and go back to child pose, or you know, whatever, you know, I forget the names, the technical terms, but, you know, whatever pose you get into between the hard poses. So I think the first thing to know is that increasing and excessive agitation or dullness is a good sign that it's about time to move back to your comfort zone, because there are ways to work with agitation and dullness in meditation. And we will always need to interact with those two factors, you know, and kind of try to tweak them and get ourselves back to the middle from the from an extreme of agitation or an extreme of dullness. But our abilities are limited. So I think sometimes noticing when we become a little checked out or a little foggy, applying an antidote, and hopefully that kind of brings things back to the middle. But if it doesn't, that may be getting to the edge of the amount of time that you can just kind of be with the discomfort. Like maybe that's the edge of your abilities. Same thing with agitation. You know, if you apply an antidote to agitation, if you're in meditation, the simplest one for agitation is just lowering your gaze a little bit, or dullness, fogginess, like raising your gaze just a little bit. Those are really simple ways of antidotes to the agitation and dullness. So if those are getting to the point where they're really not working, then that's probably as much time as you should spend in the learning zone. And you need to fall back into that comfort zone for a little while. But there's another kind of question here that is really good. And my colleague Lama Mitchell said something really wonderful the other day. And we're talking about this exact topic, actually, about how sometimes we get in these situations and we become so worried about doing the right thing, you know, the right action, you know, that actually becomes an impediment. And it's at those times that it may be helpful to remember that we all have Buddha nature. You know, our nature is already perfect. And so there are times where we can just be with our situation, just kind of dance with our environment without getting involved in trying to think about techniques and trying to think about, you know, what's the right way or what teaching, you know, applies to this thing right now. Like sometimes we can just let our Buddha nature shine through and just be, because it's here now, you know, it is our nature. So sometimes the best thing to do is to just directly engage with the situation without trying to put the conceptual overlay of all these teachings. And that's why, for instance, you know, we're called the practice lineage, the Karmakagyu lineage. And it can be a problem when we get into too much study, you know, and that is a way that talking about all this stuff, you know, can actually have a downside. You know, the more we think about this stuff, if we're thinking about it and using it as a motivation to do our practice, to do the meditation, that's good. But this is a perfect example of how concepts can get in the way, you know, and it happens for all of us. So you can kind of become crippled with all of the information that you've gotten. And because of that pile of information, you've kind of stacked over your Buddha nature, you don't notice it, you know. So that's just another way of looking at it. You know, there's kind of two ways of looking at that. There's like the one way of like if how to know if you're past, you know, your ability to grow in the learning zone. But the other angle is sometimes, you know, you can just be Buddha in a situation. And it doesn't have to involve all the concepts. So something to think about. So let's talk briefly about karma too. So karma, if we think of it in terms of habits, like the things we do get easier as we do them. And my favorite analogy for this is if you have a desk chair on carpet and you buy one of those thick plastic mats so that your desk chair can roll easily. And that those first like couple weeks with that new mat are like awesome, because it's just like you're floating on air, right? Any which way you move, the chair just goes so easily. But because of where our feet go, you know, you want to try to get the legs in a position so your feet aren't on them. So the legs end up kind of in the same place, usually every time you sit down, and that starts to make a little kind of, you know, just a little bump, you know, a little divot in the plastic. And you start to notice that, you know, like it doesn't move quite as easily anymore because those wheels sort of slip into there. And then those divots, because the wheels slip into there, they become bigger and or deeper, let's say. So now you kind of ka-chunk into them, right? Like it's not just like the easier place to go. Now they kind of like literally get pulled into those divots. And when you need to move, it's harder and harder to get out of those because they've gotten deeper, you know? So habit and karma is a lot like that, where we sort of create these grooves that we then sort of slip into. And so whether karma is good or bad is really related to whether we're creating suffering for ourselves or others. So in other words, suffering, discomfort, we know the cause of that is attachment or self-clinging. So if we are taking actions, creating habits based on self-clinging, that would be considered negative karma because that's creating suffering. So attachment, we need to remember in the moment, can actually feel really good. This is one of those things where contemplation becomes really important because I think when we talk about attachment, just purely conceptually, it's really easy to think like, yeah, that's bad. Like, no, we don't want to, I don't want to engage with that attachment. I'm going to let that go. But the fact is, in the moment, in our experience, attachment a lot of the time feels like exactly what we need. And that's really an important point. Our attachment can, in the moment, potentially help us, seem to help us palliatively, right? But we need to understand the impact of that. The impact meaning like, what grooves we're creating, you know, what habits and what propensities are we creating as we treat our discomfort palliatively. So, you know, attachment is kind of like an addiction to an opiate, you know, and it is opiate addiction too, you know, but it's this thing that sort of briefly makes us feel better. And we do need that in our lives since we are not, currently experiencing ourselves as Buddha. So we have a lot of work to do and we need to be able to find a balance. But it's important to just kind of understand that that's what's going on. And so this is how we mistake the causes of suffering for the causes of happiness and the causes of happiness for the causes of suffering. Because so often in the moment, we go for the palliative treatment, you know, we go our go-to is the comfort option. And that it seems to make us happy when in fact, it's actually contributing to the causes of suffering or vice versa. Like the thing that could actually be really helpful, like a Buddhist meditation or yoga or exercise or going to bed early, you know, and skipping those next two episodes of Mandalorian, you know, these are examples from my life for sure. So, those kind of things, may not seem like the path to happiness in the moment, on the dot, so to speak, but, we need to understand, what's happening, you know, what's the mechanism behind why we want to do these things and what will they actually lead to? Because that way we can start to tilt things in the right direction. And I'm using this kind of language like start to tilt because this is a gradual process, it's a gradual path. And little steps in the right direction help a lot. So for instance, I'm not saying if you're a person who uses relaxation apps, I'm not saying don't ever use it again at all. I'm not even saying don't use it when you normally would feel like using it. What I'm saying is, perhaps when you're about to go, you do a relaxation rather than a familiarization, that you take a moment and just be with that feeling of discomfort. And by moment, I mean moment, you know, like a second or two, you know, and you can start there. And so that's, you know, that's a good way to start to interrupt habits. You know, that's a good way to start to turn the tide. It doesn't have to be an all the time thing. You know, never again am I going to relax. Never again am I going to stay up late. Never again am I going to watch Mandalorian. So all these things are you know, little ways of beginning to create new habits, starting to create new positive habits. And so thinking about like living on the dot, you know, I was thinking about like just being in the moment, right? So what do we do with the moment? Normally we distract from the discomfort. So instead, a great way to be in the moment is to think of doing something differently. You know, I think it was Pema Chodron who said something along the lines of like, think about what you do and then do the opposite. And you don't have to do the opposite forever, but at least briefly take a moment and do something new, do something different. And not only does this help to interrupt negative habits and habits of self-clinging, but it also helps to bring this really great sense of openness and what's possible, and like a reminder that we are a process, that we are always changeable, and we can always do new things. Somebody, I had a friend text me the other day around noon and asked if I wanted to take a walk. And I try to walk every day, and I usually walk around 4 o'clock. So my reaction, and I saw this, like my reaction when I saw the text was, I don't walk till 4 o'clock. I don't know that I can go on a walk because I walk at 4. But then luckily I thought, no, this could actually be really good. You know, like I'm going to go take a walk at a different time of day. And that probably will change my whole day. You know, like my whole energy of the day is going to change if I take a noon walk. You know, I never walk at 1. At noon or 1. And it was really awesome. You know, like I think you can probably all think of examples of that where something different happens in your day and it actually makes the day seem so alive, you know, because you kind of realize like, oh, I can bust out of these habits that I'm always in. Another example of this that I've thought of lately, you know, in thinking about my favorite band, Phish, there's all these different songs, but they jam them. So they're always like slightly different. And that to a fan is exciting. You know, like a song done differently is really exciting. But if you think about little diversions from routine in your day, I think a lot of the time we meet those with fear or trepidation rather than like intrigue and excitement, you know? So, I think that it's a good thing to really try to switch it up, you know, to try to like do new things, even just briefly, even just for seconds, you know, like, again, that will both help to turn the tide towards positive habits and also help to remind us that we are fresh and new and can be, you know, all sorts of things that we don't even realize. So. So a few points to wrap up here. So non-attachment, when we talk about non-attachment, that doesn't mean non-engagement. We can still engage in things that relax us. And similarly, we can still engage in renunciation, in giving up. But balance is the key, you know, and the Buddha taught the middle way. So finding some kind of balance is really key. And we can achieve that balance primarily with a keen awareness of the situation in ourselves and the mindfulness to act skillfully. So we cultivate awareness and mindfulness in a session of meditation. Those are the two things we're doing in a session of shamatha, the meditation we practiced earlier. The active, if there is an active component, like what we're trying to accomplish in the session of meditation is not relaxation. It is cultivating mindfulness and cultivating awareness. Mindfulness being, what are we doing? And the awareness being, what's happening? You know, so I said earlier too, that like, we're trying to notice what's happening and notice what we're doing with it, right? So in a session of meditation, we're trying to notice both what's happening in our mind and our experience, and then also what are we doing with that? And the what are we doing with it part has to be something, right? Noticing is just open, but what are we doing is a practical matter. So that's why there's the instruction, place the attention on the breath, because that's what we're doing. in a session of meditation. That's the practical aspect. And through placing the attention on the breath and noticing everything else that's happening, and then what do we do when we're distracted? We bring our attention back. We cultivate mindfulness and awareness. And we can do that off the cushion too. And there's lots of ways of doing that. You could kind of just take that same technique and apply it with whatever thing you're doing, whether it's walking or eating or any sort of activity, just kind of putting your attention on the activity. And then when you notice thinking, bring your attention back. So that's one way of applying mindfulness off the cushion. Another is noticing when attachment arises, noticing when we are about to kind of paper over that discomfort, and instead purposefully interrupting that habit of attachment, even again, just briefly, just for a moment, and then maybe extending that over time, seeing how long we can actually just sort of sit with that discomfort. Interestingly, a lot of, I think, what discomfort is to us is just our mind. You know, it's just, thoughts arising in our mind, but we really have the sense that we need to do something to get rid of those thoughts or to hide from them. And that's not non-attachment, you know? So it's important to be able to just briefly at least interrupt those habits of attachment. Also, I would say celebrating moments of awareness. And that means celebrating when you recognize that you've gone astray. If you notice that you've done something that you regret, that's enough. You know, you don't have to kind of wallow in regret or punish yourself with regret, you know, or flog yourself with regret. Regret is a good thing because it's awareness arising to try to keep us on track. And then we should take that regret and resolve not to repeat whatever it was, you know, that we regret, and then move on. You know, that's non-attachment, you know, and awareness, you know, having awareness of what happened, we went off the path, and then mindfully resolving not to do that again, and then returning to our path. So that's a really important one, because I think a lot of times when we notice that things have gone wrong, we create the mental habit of regretting the awareness rather than regretting the action and then turning that into something useful and making a resolution not to repeat it. And we also talked about just kind of switching things up throughout the day. And so one last interesting point, I feel like there's a talk, maybe this is a preview of an upcoming talk, but I was really thinking about the intersections of mindfulness in both repetition and in chaos. So like the difficulty and the unique challenges of maintaining familiarity, you know, open awareness and also like a practical mindfulness in the midst of a repetitive situation, a situation that seems to repeat over and over and over again. So like earlier I said about thinking of each song, you know, as like each new version of a song is like a new adventure. Similarly, like each day is probably like that. You know, if we have the same commute to work every day, the same breakfast every day, things start to seem like they just happen in the same way over and over and over again. So it becomes a little bit tougher to be mindful. Like those types of situations can lull us into dullness, you know? But I think that creating our own little chaos in the midst of the repetition can actually be really beneficial way to achieve some balance there, you know? So switching things up, you know, have a different class for your tea in the morning. Maybe you wash the dishes right after you use them rather than leaving them in the sink. I don't have a roommate, I'm talking about myself. And then likewise in chaos, you know, in situations where things seem so unfamiliar and unpredictable, I think that can have us maybe tend towards agitation. It could be, each of these situations could go either way, but I think in chaos, a lot of times we start to cling to what's the idea? And this is happening. I don't understand that. What's the best way for me to work with this? So putting a little bit of repetition into our chaos maybe is helpful. And what I mean by that is like, that may be just doing what we would normally do in the midst of changing circumstances. So I think a good example of this is maintaining our practice when things seem to be falling down around us, which I think we've all been in situations like that. You know, like that becomes even more important to maintain our daily practice when things seem like they're just kind of out of control. So in all these cases, though, mindfulness and awareness are the same. Mindfulness and awareness don't change. I'm talking about the circumstances that change. So that's about all the time I have. So if anyone has any further questions, let me know. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today, and thank you for spending time here. I know everyone's time is valuable, and I'm just so grateful that that you chose to spend it here with Columbus KTC. And I hope that you will take the time to contemplate this stuff and try to see how it applies in your life. You know, these teachings are really just kind of not meaningless, but they're not going to do anything if you don't integrate them into your own experience. So that's really the key. Like, these are yours. You just have to kind of open the package, right? So and then you have to meditate, you know. So that's really the third step here. You've listened, now it's time to contemplate and also to meditate. And that was a great question earlier, because contemplation is separate from meditation. And then when you meditate, you're basically just practicing letting go, you know. So you deal with the concepts, and then you deal without the concepts. That's the meditation aspect. So thank you to everybody. I hope that everything I said today was accurate. I confess any errors I may have made. I rejoice in all the good works of our teachers and in all of your practice. And I pray that our teachers remain for a long time and continue to teach. And let's dedicate the merit of today. So we'll chant both of these. The first one here is like the practical methods. So practically speaking, we're going to try to benefit beings. And then the second prayer, the second four lines will be, you'll see some names you may or may not recognize. But basically we're praying to enlightened beings and saying like, I'm sorry, but I don't yet understand how things actually work. And please help me to do it how you understand it. You know, because you're enlightened, please help me to do this how you would do it. So we'll do the first four lines, and then I'll scroll down and we'll do the second four lines. Through this merit, may all beings obtain omniscience and defeat our common enemies, the defects of samsara. From the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may we free all beings. And then second part. The courageous Manjushri, who knows everything as it is, Samantabhadra, who also knows in the same way, and all the bodhisattvas, that I may follow in their path, I completely dedicate all this virtue. All right. Thank you, everybody. I'll see you soon.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.